Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new episode of Stories from Space podcast, where your host, Matthew Williams, examines the history of human spaceflight, the breakthroughs that revolutionized our understanding of the universe and our place in it, and the brave individuals who work tirelessly to advance the frontiers of our understanding. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
The authors acknowledge that this podcast was recorded on the traditional unceded lands of the Lekwungen peoples.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Stories from Space. I'm your host, Matt Williams, and joining me today is a very special guest, noted engineer, planetary scientist, and the principal investigator of the New Horizons mission, Dr. Alan Stern. Dr. Stern is also a commercial astronaut, aerospace consultant, and the chief scientist at Moon Express, a commercial space company dedicated to lunar mining and development. He is also the author of several books, including The U.S. Space Program After Challenger, Worlds Beyond, Pluto and Charon, and Chasing New Horizons Inside the First Epic Mission to Pluto. Dr. Stern, welcome aboard.
I appreciate it.
Dr. Stern, with your permission, I'd like to jump right in and discuss something very exciting of which you are part. Yourself and colleagues from the Southwest Research Institute, you recently conducted a study on a interstellar object explorer, a spacecraft concept that could rendezvous with interstellar objects and study them up close. Now, first of all, can you give us a little background on why ISOs have become such a subject of interest in recent years?
Sure, absolutely. As a research community, the planetary science and astronomy fields have predicted for decades, literally stretching back into the earliest days of space exploration, that we would eventually discover objects floating through interstellar space that are castaways from other solar systems that just happen to come through our solar system. And there have been searches for these in the past, which were unsuccessful, but really the technology wasn't available to do the kind of search necessary to actually find one until 2017, when the first of these objects was discovered.
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua, that's exactly the name of it, passing through our solar system in 2017 at very high speed. Another, called Borisov, was discovered in 2019. And although we have not found more since, based upon the two detections that have been made, we're pretty confident that with the advent of a new observatory that's coming online thanks to the National Science Foundation, beginning next year, we should detect one to several of these per year, every year from now on. And that opens up the possibility that we may be able to get spacecraft to some of them. It'd be very valuable to do because we've never studied something formed outside of our solar system up close and personal with a spacecraft the way that we study asteroids and comets and Kuiper Belt objects. And having the opportunity for those objects to come visit us and to get a spacecraft to fly by them would be really high value science.
And this concept, of course, it's the catching up to an interstellar object. As you said, next year we'll be detecting more of them. And this would be because that's when the Vera C. Rubin Observatory is going to be gathering its first light.
Yep, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, now called Vera Rubin Observatory, will come on late this year and start scanning the sky more or less making motion pictures of the sky down to extremely faint objects, and should catch things like this on a regular basis. Once we determine their orbits, we can find out which ones come close enough to the Earth to send an interceptor there.
And in fact, the detection of Oumuamua and Borisov, I personally felt that just the nature of these two objects, how they're detected rather close together in terms of just timing, that it was really quite indicative in a way. It was like Oumuamua confounded astronomers for quite a while, whereas Borisov, it was clear almost right away, wasn't it, that it was a comet?
Well, we're not sure what these things are, and having studied two of them is a very small sample. Interstellar space is almost certainly teeming with ejecta from solar systems all around the galaxy. So there's almost without a doubt, there's a wide variety of objects out there, ranging from rocks and boulders to things that are the size of comets and asteroids, even up to the size of planets that'll be free-floating in interstellar space. Now, there are many fewer planets than there are comet-sized things, and there's still more boulder-sized things. But in the study of how solar systems form in general around other stars and how planets form around other stars, we've never had an opportunity to actually see something up close to understand its geology and surface composition and other properties the way that we have studied the building blocks of planets in our own solar system. And now we're just reaching the brink of having the ground-based technology to find those objects. And we have the space-based technology, if the money's available, to build an interceptor and go to one of them. And I think that'd be really exciting.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, basically, we would be looking at a sample from another star system. It's the next best thing to actually going there, isn't it?
Yeah, and it saves the long hike across interstellar space because they come close to us.
Well, now, this puts me in mind here. In terms of your study and the spacecraft you're envisioning there, can you give us a quick rundown on the kind of technology it would use? Like, for starters, propulsion.
Well, let me start at the big picture, and then I'll come to propulsion. First of all, what we determined in our study is that we have the technology now, that we don't need to invent anything in order to make a mission like this possible. We just have to decide to build it and build it. It requires conventional power systems, conventional communications, conventional propulsion, conventional scientific instruments. And the reason is that we're going to go after an object coming from another star system that comes pretty close to the Earth. Not right up to the Earth, but that is certainly closer than Jupiter's orbit. And we're not going to try to match speeds with it and rendezvous with it. We're just going to make a fast flyby, like the first missions to Halley's Comet back in the 80s, or like even the New Horizons mission that I led to Pluto, where our orbit, that is the orbit of the spacecraft and the orbit of the interstellar object, just cross on a given day, and the spacecraft gets very, very close, where it can train its cameras and spectrometers on the interstellar object and determine what it's made of, determine how it was formed and how it has evolved, what its geology and geochemistry are, its density, some of its internal properties. Look for an atmosphere around it. If it's like a comet, we'll call that a coma. Determine what that's made of. And then send all that data back to Earth for us to pour over as a first mission to a first interstellar object. Same way that we've now made the first mission to Pluto, the first mission to a Kuiper Belt object, and many missions to asteroids and comets. It was the discovery of Oumuamua and Borisov that really caused us to go take a hard look at how you would do this. Others have taken a look too, and although they've come up with some somewhat different ways of going about it, the common thread is that it is doable, it is affordable, it is within our present technology. And so it's the kind of thing that NASA or ESA could choose to do and would have high scientific impact. But I should also caution that the object we fly by may not be anything like a Kuiper Belt object or an asteroid or a comet. We don't know. It's just a random object from the interstellar grab bag that we can reach, and we'll have to see what it's like. And that's part of the fun, but it's also just reality. We cannot tell before we get there very much about it, and very few of them come close enough to be able to reach with present technology. So in that sense, we're beggars, and beggars can't be choosers. When we build a spacecraft and buy a rocket and are ready to do this, we'll probably go after the very first one we can reach.
Well, in fact, that was part of your study too, was the limits of detectability and the potential for rendezvousing with it. And as I recall from the paper, you established some parameters and said that there were velocity requirements, yes, but also the likelihood of being able to rendezvous with an object. It got better as you're approaching two astronomical units, right? As the object itself was two astronomical units from the sun.
Well, as the objects come closer to the sun, they're brighter and easier to detect and track. That's the good news. The bad news is when they're closer to the sun, we have less and less time to affect the intercept before they fly away. Mm-hmm. So it's a fine balance between trying to search for interstellar objects far enough out to be able to get on the way to them before they're gone, and having them come so close before their detection that we don't have the time for that. So our solution, there are different ways to go about this, but our preferred solution is to launch a mission into space and have it loiter, wait to make the big final targeting burn with the upper stage of the rocket to get it on its way. And it might wait for years while the ground-based observatories like Vera Rubin scan the skies, find interstellar objects, and we cross-match them against our propulsive capability until we find one that we can actually get that spacecraft to before it's gone. And then we light the engines on that rocket and send the spacecraft already in space on its way. And that's superior to keeping it on the ground for a number of reasons. One is getting things to a launch pad on short order is a tall order. It's really a real headache when launch pads are in short supply as they are, and there are many other satellites and exploration spacecraft that want to get launched. If you just keep your spacecraft in a warehouse and its rocket in a warehouse nearby, and suddenly you have an opportunity to fly it to an interstellar object, your launch pad may or may not be available. Putting it in space where you can control when you make that final engine firing is a much more surefire way of making sure that when we find the right object to go after, we're able to go right after it.
And you sort of alluded to earlier the fact that there are other teams looking at other proposals. And one that sort of pops for me was Project Lyra. And that was from the Institute of Interstellar Studies, and Marshall Eubanks was the principal investigator. Now, that envisioned using laser sails and directed energy propulsion. But yeah, you guys, on the other hand, were looking at rockets, boosters, etc.
Well, the team of people that I assembled, mostly at the Southwest Research Institute, but also some outside collaborators, and Southwest Research Institute's my home institution, have a great deal of experience in spaceflight and also a pretty high batting average at winning competitive proposals. And our ground rule was that we should find a technique that doesn't require inventing anything we don't absolutely have to. No one has laser sails like that or laser guns to propel those sails. And if I wrote a proposal around that, it might get an A for ingenuity, but it would get an F for doability. And it would probably fail on cost as well. So we chose to only study things that we know how to do today with conventional rockets, conventional propulsion, conventional spacecraft. And it turns out it works. We can do it just like we do a mission to Venus or Mars or a comet or an asteroid. And the only difference is we're flying to a different kind of target with very special scientific importance.
In fact, yeah, that's a very key thing, isn't it, when it comes to design studies that are actually likely to produce a mission. Can we do this today? It's fair to say that's the whole point of doing such a study, isn't it?
Well, we could, yes. The point isn't to publish papers about how to do it. The point is to actually get a spacecraft out there to make a flyby and discover things about the object. And as you probably know, when NASA calls for proposals, or the European Space Agency calls for proposals, they're very heavily oversubscribed. They'll typically be 20 or 30, 500 to 1,000 page proposals detailing how to do different missions, out of which one gets selected. It's very steep competition. Sometimes two get selected, but still two out of 20 or two out of 30 is still very steep odds. And so if you want to get selected, you not only have to have blockbuster science, but the story has to fit with confidence within the cost and schedule and technology base that we have. It has to be a completely airtight story that you're going to be able to execute that mission with confidence and get the goods.
So in fact, in terms of next steps, is there currently a plan to build on this study, hopefully attract NASA funding, and eventually lead to a Pathfinder type mission that could actually be ready to go in the not too distant future?
Well, in the case of NASA, the most natural program for this is called Discovery. Discovery's been around since the 1990s, and every few years NASA asks for proposals, which, as I said, they're very detailed. They involve teams of sometimes hundreds of people, engineers and scientists. They can be 1,000 pages thick, and they typically are about that, with spacecraft design, instrument design, ground system design, trajectories, cost plans, management plans, and much more. NASA puts those through a gauntlet of green eyeshade reviews to make sure that every aspect of it holds water, and then they rank them. And then out of that ranking comes usually 2, 3, 4 that they will select as finalists for more study for a year or so. And then from that study of the finalists, one, occasionally two, get selected. So for teams like my own that might be interested in doing this, you have to get your precursor work done and be ready when NASA calls proposals to field a team and write a proposal that's going to pass through that gauntlet and come out on top.
Yes.
This is ready to propose. But NASA only calls for Discovery mission proposals every several years. NASA has not announced a firm date for the next time they call for proposals. And our team and others might propose for that. But frankly, since it is very competitive, that's the kind of thing that we keep under wraps for competitive advantage. So you just have to stay tuned. I'm sorry.
not a problem. So regarding what the discovery, the detection of Oumuamua and Borisov set off, there were many papers that came out from this in terms of the implications that these detections themselves had. And you mentioned how the number of interstellar objects that enter our system, there's estimates on that. There's estimates on how many we could detect. There was also research that indicated that some of these interstellar objects may actually still be in our solar system, that over time, some that arrive get captured and they're still here. And so that too, the prospect of finding ones that stay, that has also been proposed as a mission idea, has it not?
I don't know anyone who's studied how to do that as a mission. It is true that occasionally these objects can get trapped in our solar system, but it's very rare because they come by at such high speed. It's very hard for them to get captured into orbit around one of the planets or around the sun. And I believe the odds are just astronomically against that millions of objects have to go by in order to get one captured. And it might be even steeper than millions. It might be billions or trillions, but it's extremely rare. So the best way to get a mission to examine one of these is to go after one that's just passing by, because we know that there are going to be just one to several of those every year now that the Vera Rubin telescope is coming online. And so that enables a way to do this sooner rather than later. If you want to find ways to do it differently, to catch up with these objects, to orbit them, to find them orbiting a planet or orbiting the sun, that's a much tougher problem. And it's not ready for prime time. I'm all about pragmatism. It's better to have 80% of something, I always say, than 100% of nothing. We want to get a mission to an object like this. We want to choose the easiest way to get a first mission there. Then we'll worry about the second mission.
Well, actually, just one other question that you put me in mind of. There have been proposals. In fact, I think this was the crux of Project Lyra. It was to catch up with Oumuamua, and that there had been some speculation that, done right, a mission could actually reach that mysterious object itself and not wait for the next one. Is that a feasible possibility at this point?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. We found it difficult to put together a mission that's going to fit within the budgets of the Discovery Program, with doable technology and a straightforward execution plan that goes after a new one that's discovered years from now once the spacecraft is built. Catching up with one that's already long gone is a much tougher assignment. For one thing, by the time you get there, it's going to be very far from the sun. You can't use solar arrays. You're going to need nuclear power like we had on New Horizons. And that alone is more expensive and much more time consuming. So I don't see a strong reason to go after Oumuamua other than interest and the open problems about it when we've got new objects coming through our solar system all the time that Vera Rubin will discover. And then we'll have the pick of the litter.
So bottom line is, our best bet is to wait for future ISOs and to have a mission ready to rendezvous with them than to look for those that might have stayed or try to catch up with the ones we've already seen.
I think that's right.
Yes. And well, you know, I certainly wish you the best of luck in terms of this project and others that stand to tell us a great deal more about formation and evolution of star systems. If I could ask you to opine there just a little bit, what we could stand to learn from an ISO, I mean, it would be rather profound.
Well, I think we'll learn about how, we'll see an example of how these objects formed around some other star system. And since we're taking a random grab bag sample, we're going to go after the first one we can reach. We have to assume that it's probably typical of how a lot of these objects form. And if that is like the objects in our own solar system, that's very important confirmation that all the things we're learning about how planets and the seeds of planets form apply in many other instances across the galaxy. On the other hand, if we discover that that object was formed very differently, and its chemistry is very different, its composition, that is, and its geology, and it is very alien compared to the objects we see in our solar system, that's another important data point. And either way, I think it's landmark. We'll just have to see what the data tells us. But I'm excited because I think this will capture the public imagination, and we know it's scientifically important and it's actually doable. I wasn't sure when we got started if it would turn out to be doable within the present technology and within cost constraints, but it looks like it is.
Well, that's very encouraging, and I'm really happy for that result. It was exciting to read about. So thank you for conducting the study. And yeah, naturally, I hope this will someday lead to a mission itself that a little
bear. Thank you. Our team was very happy with the way it turned out. And thank you for your interest in it. Very appreciated.
No problem. And naturally, I hope to get you back on here to discuss the many, many, many other topics of which you are, well, an informed expert. Not the least of which includes the outer solar system. Pluto, Kuiper Belt, Charon, all those wonderful places.
I appreciate it.
For those who are interested in learning more about our topic today, you can read the proposal paper titled A Study of an Interstellar Object Explorer Mission, which was recently published in the journal Planetary and Space Science. And listeners are encouraged to also check out Dr. Stern's website at alanstern.space, where you can also learn about Dr. Stern's latest books and publications and upcoming speaking events, of which there are many, and no doubt many more to come. And stay tuned for future episodes in which I hope Dr. Stern will be able to tell us about his most well-known success, which is being the principal investigator of the first mission to ever rendezvous with Pluto and Kuiper Belt objects, New Horizons. In the meantime, thank you for listening. I'm Matt Williams, and this has been Stories from Space.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stories from Space podcast with Matthew Williams. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPMagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.